What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ed Hagem, a prominent financial investment firm CEO who was raised in an orphan home and is the author of the compelling new memoir, The Road Less Traveled. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking lately about God in our world and the complex ways we relate to our deity, however conceived. What provoked this was two things. First, a section of the weekly Torah portion 8 days ago or so that included the Shlosh Esrei Midot, the 13 attributes of God, which offer God's own definition of God's intrinsic nature. The second was a book I've been reading by the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Boy, important questions today. The Exodus section is God's self-revelation about what qualities God possesses, while in his book, Haidt analyzes how human beings think, what reason and rationality really are, and how this impacts the way we think about crucial issues, including God and religion. There's a fascinating interplay between these two texts. The Torah passage in question reads, I, the Lord, am a compassionate God of grace, long-suffering, filled with kindness and truth, conferring kindness to the thousandth generation, removing iniquity, transgression, and sin, and purifying. If you look closely at that section in Exodus, it's repeated several times in the Hebrew Bible, it focuses on two aspects of divine power. First, the compassion or kindness God shows us, and then, equally importantly, the fact that God forgives our sins. That combination certainly has its attractions for those who do believe in God or any higher power. The promise of divine kindness married to forgiveness for the mistakes we inevitably make. That is, in a small but important bundle, the essence of all religion. God has given us a good and generous world and offers relief from the burden of the bad actions we take. Of course, rationalists generally say that such a belief in a kind and forgiving deity is not reasonable. Our minds should be clear, analytical tools that aren't confused by archaic notions of a supreme being or higher power. We might seek kindness and forgiveness from other humans, but we cannot expect to receive these from God, if God even exists. Reason rules. Jonathan Haidt takes a different tack about reason, basing his argument on empirical, scientific, psychological studies of the way human beings really think and act, he explains that rather than rationally analyzing and understanding the world, what we think of as rational thought or the faculty of reason is typically a post facto attempt to justify what we have already intuitively decided. That is, we choose to do what we want to do, or choose to think what we want to think, then justify it by forging a rational defense for our own actions. Many of our quote-unquote rational choices about good and evil, or how to conduct ourselves, are really not rational at all. According to the social psychologist Haidt, they are simply things we choose to do because we like to do them, or want to do them, or our own innate biases lead us to act. And we then carefully explain how our choice was rational. Which means that our values and ethics have at least as good a chance to flourish positively by being rooted in a received religious tradition, like Judaism, as they do if we try to cultivate meaningful morality from our own faculties. Personal reason, apparently, has very little to do with pristine objective choice and much more to do with our own cultural and personal biases and our blinded effort to prove that we did it all ourselves with no help from God or any godlike creature. If Haidt's extensive research into the concept of the righteous mind is correct, and many smart people think he is, we humans have innate desires and needs first, then we justify them by calling them rational and constructing reasons, even systems around them. But most of these decisions aren't truly rational at all, and have nothing to do with what is really right. So what's the solution to the dilemma of our quite imperfect reason? Perhaps it lies in accepting that there is a higher level of thought and meaning than the merely personal biases we exercise as, quote-unquote, rational, and allowing those ideals and concepts, such as God's gift of a generous world, God's ever-present forgiveness for those who atone, to influence our own actions and choices, and so to improve our conduct, and perhaps even our world. To play us in this morning from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, here's a lovely little Sephardic version of the Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach, the order of the ritual meal, from Chaim Parchi.
Kadesh Urhatz Harpas Yahatz Magid Racha Motzi Matza Maror Korech Shulchan Orech Tafun Barech Ale Nirta.
That was the Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach for Passover, coming up 2 weeks from last night. Don't miss our virtual Seder, a part together, a seat at the rabbi's table, from Congregation Beit Simcha, beitsimchatucson.org. When we return on To Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Ed Hagim, a hugely successful financial entrepreneur and company builder, tells us about his extremely humble beginnings, the way he rose from an orphan home to great professional and personal success, and just how that complicated tale came about. Find out about it. You won't want to miss his great story when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the foothills mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus sorus, a group can still join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. We wear masks and practice social distancing, but people are there in person. You can also join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Facebook Live Shabbat Evening Celebration Services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. We'll continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, many of those also in blended formats, as are our religious school classes and our Torah Tykes program. You can access all of that. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A. Passover's coming up fast. You have a chance to celebrate with a part together, a seat at the rabbi's table. Come virtually to Passover with us. Should be fabulous. BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught on Zoom and in person, and of course, all of our services on Facebook Live or in person, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish synagogue in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Ed Hagim is the author of an extraordinary biography, On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. A highly successful financial manager and philanthropist, but that's not how it started. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
So you started out life, actually started out life in a place you didn't remember starting out life. Tell us a little bit about the beginning of your story.
Well, the beginning of my story, you know, it starts with my father, who basically was, they were immigrants, they came over in 1900. And my father was fascinated as a young man with radio. And during the 1920s, when the U.S. went crazy over radio, my father became quite wealthy. And in 1929, owned property in Manhattan and a home, and even I have a picture of him with his own airplane and so on. But between 29 and 33, he lost everything, and completely. And by 1933, he said, he had a decision to make between going to California or committing suicide. And thank God, as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad he decided to go to California.
Yeah, of course.
On the way to California, he stopped at a cousin, an unwelcome stop, but the cousin had five children, the fifth of which was an 18-year-old daughter, and my father was then 33, and surprising to both of them, in 2 weeks they got married.
Huh.
And we proceeded on to California. He was a very attractive man, and he had a car, which I guess was a big deal in those days. Everybody was, obviously, in 1933, very in great difficulty. In California, things didn't change much, and according to my father, the only really happiness the two of them had was my birth in 1936. And on my birth certificate, it showed that I was born to an unemployed father and a homemaker mother.
Mm.
Father was a very strict man. He was like, if you've read Leon Muir's book, The Hodge, he was like Abraham.
Yeah.
He was a very powerful man. You went his way.
And I should note he was a Syrian Jew, probably descended from Aleppo Jews, I would assume.
He was a Syrian Jew born in Aleppo, supposedly. He was very strong, and he basically ruled my mother, you know, unmercifully. They ate a certain way. She dressed a certain way. She couldn't work. And after 3 years of this, or 6 years of it, 3 years after I was born, my mother decided that she was going to divorce my father. And so she did, and it was shocking in those days, 1939, a 24-year-old woman doesn't leave a home, but she did. And she took me from Los Angeles, where we were living, to St. Louis, where her family was living. And she was unwelcome there. They didn't need another two mouths to feed.
Sure.
And my father got alimony and $5 a week of child support, and he got visiting rights on Sunday. So I guess a month or so later, driving from Los Angeles to St. Louis, he picked me up for his Sunday visit. He found me not terribly well kept, made him very unhappy. So instead of taking me to the movies, he got on Highway 66, and we started to drive back to California. And he essentially kidnapped me, which I didn't realize until many years later. Kidnapped me, and in a few short period later, told him my mother had died and I would never see her again. for about 2 years.
Now, how old were you when this happened?
So you were 3 years old.
And then gradually he came to tell you that she died in childbirth, right?
Yeah, he said she died in childbirth, exactly. So, and I didn't understand what childbirth meant, and I obviously didn't understand that she died. I just had my father, and we were buddies, and but he still was going, he was basically, his radio training ended up training him as a radio operator aboard a ship. So he spent most of his time aboard sea, and even in the first 2 years we were together, he spent a period of time aboard a ship and going to Australia and back, and I spent time with the Mrs. Benson. And toward the end of the tour, he basically saved some money, bought some Japanese fishing, some fishing boats, staffed them with Japanese fishermen, and I actually spent quite a wonderful time on these boats for about 6 months. But then the World War broke out.
Wow.
The Japanese were impounded. He lost, he obviously leveraged the boats. He bought them on debt. And lost the boats, lost everything, and ended up either volunteering or being drafted into the Merchant Marines as a lieutenant radio officer aboard a ship. And that started my 13-year ejira of foster homes and orphanages.
So we will pick up the story. It's a fascinating story when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish with our guest, Ed Hagen. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Lithuania and Poland and the sort of reckoning with the Holocaust that's going on now, or, I don't know, revisionist history. Tell us a little bit about one story from, well, that area.
Okay, so just a brief vignette before we move on to Poland. Although, as I said earlier, Poland and Lithuania were once a commonwealth,
yeah,
and they were the
right.
largest, most powerful country in Europe for a few hundred years, and no one thinks of either of those countries as having once been a powerhouse. That was before three partitions of Poland, which basically wiped Poland off the map, and before the Tsarist Empire incorporated Lithuania, which effectively wiped Lithuania off the map. In any case, Vilna was always this trove of Jewish scholarship and learning and printing and all of that. And during the Nazi occupation, the Nazis set up a commission of Jewish intellectuals, authors, and poets to go through all the printed matter and tell the Germans what each thing was so they could decide whether to burn them or to send them back to Germany for a museum, whatever. Anyway, it was clear the Germans were planning to either appropriate or destroy all of this printed material. So the guys on this commission who had to go back to the ghetto every night to sleep started smuggling stuff out. You know, other people smuggled food into the ghetto. These guys smuggled books. And I just read very recently, like within the past 48 hours, about this. And I flashed back to my first visit to Vilnius in 1972, when it was still part of the Soviet Union. And the shul there was quite run down, and there were only like a handful of old men who never saw a minyan, except I brought a group of campers from the Ramah system who could lead services and daven impressively and participate, and it really brought a light to the eyes of all these old men who never thought they'd see a Jewish future. And they would not have dreamed that Vilna would be revived quite to the extent that it is. There's a Jewish museum, that synagogue was restored beautifully, whatever. But meanwhile, this trove of books had made its way into the back of the synagogue, and so all the shelves were overflowing with books, and there were stacks on the floor, and they were all old, and nobody used them. So at the end of services, which were basically led by my kids, the old men said, anybody who wants to take a book, please take one or two. We would be happy to know that they're being used and enjoyed and appreciated somewhere instead of sitting here just gathering dust. So pretty much every kid in that group has a book or two that was saved by this special commission appointed by the Nazis during the Holocaust.
Incredible story. Some other stuff going on now in Poland. They passed a law recently, a couple of years ago, under the very conservative government there, that you can't say anything negative, more or less, about Poles during the Holocaust, not non-Jewish Poles, except, I guess, portraying them as either heroes or victims of the Holocaust. At least that's how it's been reported in the press. I don't read Polish. And they've recently had a case that popped up.
Right, there was like a Supreme Court case involving two historians who wrote an article.
No, they wrote a book. It's excellent historians who, you know, a giant documentation of the actions.
Well, maybe to publicize that book, they wrote an article.
Yeah, that's correct.
Got wider
yeah.
distribution.
That's right.
And the Polish state, the government, contends that Poles were victims, they were not accomplices of the Nazis, and they did nothing for which they should ever be criticized. And that's probably a little bit too extreme to correspond with the reality of what happened, which is there were a lot of righteous Poles who hid Jews and saved Jewish lives and whatever. There were also a lot who were complicit with the Nazis, and authoritarian governments don't like shades of gray. Has to be black or white. So they see any questioning of Polish heroism and resistance and everybody was wearing a white hat as painting Poland black. And they don't like that. There's a huge amount of sensitivity. And this also will require some sort of national introspection and reckoning. And I would say in the meantime, anybody who writes about the Polish role in the Holocaust should also remember the hundreds, probably thousands, of righteous Gentiles who, at the risk of their own lives, helped Jews to survive the war. I once told a story on air about a group of my kids who were kicked off a train at midnight. And,
yeah.
Right? You remember that
story? Yeah, I remember that story.
All
sure,
right,
absolutely.
So that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is talking to his psychiatrist as he lies on the couch. I had the weirdest dream last night, he says. I saw my mother, but I realized she had your face. I found this so troubling. I woke up immediately and I couldn't get back to sleep all night. I stayed there thinking about that dream. Finally, at 7 a.m., I got up, made myself a slice of toast and coffee, and came straight here. Doctor, please, can you tell me the meaning of this dream? And the psychiatrist says, one slice of toast and coffee? That you call a breakfast? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the middle book of the Torah, Leviticus. The Hebrew name comes from its first word, Vayikra, God called. There's a famous idiosyncrasy about the Aleph, the last Hebrew letter in the word Vayikra, as it's written in the Torah, because it's written smaller than the other letters. Aleph, the Midrash tells us, is the first letter of the word Ani, I. Therefore, if we wish God to call us directly, we must diminish our focus on I. Seek to limit our egotism. If we can do that, then we, like Moses, will be able to clearly hear God's call to respond, and so find the holiness that makes up the central subject of this book of Leviticus. Less of the I and more of God. Very nice interpretation indeed. But there's something rather puzzling about this midrash, too. If Moses, our great leader, was truly the humblest man in the world, just how did he have the ego strength to lead an enormously fractious group of Jews across a wilderness to the promised land, often seemingly against their will? How could anyone so humble and modest manage to lead this people through all the trials and tribulations described in the Torah? Perhaps the secret lies in the inner strength that can come only from faith. Faced with the vicissitudes of life and the challenges and demands of a world that is far from either completion or wholeness, our own arrogance cannot carry us to any promised land we seek. But trust in a God who implants within each of us a spark of the divine, a core element of holiness we can draw upon at times of crisis, can bring us to a better place. Moses realized that he himself was unfit for the task that God assigned him. So he was indeed humble. But he also knew that the God he believed in and whose mitzvot he followed was infinitely powerful and profoundly holy. If he, a fallible human being, simply placed his confidence and trust in God, he, Moses, could ultimately succeed. So too for us. We can't really do it alone, however we define it. But if we place our faith in God and know that God can and will help, we may become like Moses, humble but holy. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Ed Hajim, will explain how he overcame an incredibly complicated childhood to rise to great success and how he has chosen to give back in tzedakah. Hear all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Lots of Jewish sports news this week. It may seem strange, but I'm developing huge respect for a football player on the New England Patriots. Julian Edelman, the Jewish wide receiver who was the most valuable player a couple of Super Bowls ago, is in the news for again responding to an anti-Semitic incident involving a professional sports player. This time it was NBA basketball player Myers Leonard, a forward for the Miami Heat, who was caught on a live stream using the K-word towards a woman competitor in a video game. The K-word isn't quite as bad as the N-word, I suppose, but it's not much better, and Leonard was immediately put on administrative leave by his team, owned, by the way, by Mickey Arison, a Jewish Israeli-American, and he was later fined $50,000 by the NBA, whose commissioner, Adam Silver, is also proudly Jewish. By the way, Myers Leonard used some other language towards the woman involved that was vile and misogynistic, but the focus has been on his anti-Semitic comment. After the video clip circulated widely on social media and was condemned by his teammates, Myers Leonard apologized to the Jewish community and specifically to the Heat's Jewish owner, Arison. He said he was ignorant of what the word meant. Julian Edelman previously did educational work with DeSean Jackson, a wide receiver then with the Eagles, who also used some anti-Semitic language in social media. And Jackson, at the time, played for a team also owned by a Jewish man. Actually, the general manager there was also Jewish. Julian Edelman invited DeSean Jackson to tour the Holocaust Museum with him in D.C. What attracted attention this time was the outstanding message that Julian Edelman sent to Myers Leonard. In an open letter on Twitter, he said, "So we've never met. I hope we can one day soon. I get the sense that you didn't use that word out of hate, more out of ignorance. Most likely you weren't trying to hurt anyone or even profile Jews in your comment. That's what makes it so destructive. Casual ignorance is harder to combat and has greater reach, especially when you command great influence. Hate is like a virus. Even accidentally, it can rapidly spread. I'm down in Miami fairly frequently. Let's do a Shabbat dinner with some friends, and I'll show you a fun time." You know, I'm not a Patriots fan at all, but I sure now am a Julian Edelman fan. In other Jewish sports news, former Dodgers catcher Norm Sherry passed away last week. He and his brother Larry Sherry were the very first Jewish battery mates to appear in Major League Baseball history together, that is, pitcher-catcher. Sherry grew up in L.A. and went to Fairfax High, was part of the 1959 World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers team. His brother Larry was the MVP of that series, and he later coached several teams and managed the then California Angels in the 1970s. But Norm Sherry is best known for a little advice he gave a young, wild Jewish left-hander back in spring training 1961, 60 years ago now. After Sandy Koufax walked the first three batters of a spring game in Florida, his catcher, Norm Sherry, went to the mound and said, "Sandy, don't throw so hard. Just get the ball in there. We don't have a lot of pitchers available to pitch today." And for some reason, it took. As soon as Koufax, then an ordinary, not terribly effective pitcher, well, as soon as he did that, he not only threw strikes, but he ended up throwing even harder with much less effort. And soon, Koufax was the best pitcher on the planet, the best Jewish baseball player ever, in part thanks to Norm Sherry. May he rest in peace. I'm not trying to say that all great children's books have been Jewish, but a lot of them have. And we lost a great author of one last week.
There was once a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself. Not just sometimes, but always.
Norton Juster died last week. His fabulous children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth, influenced many of our childhoods growing up. With its famous beginning, there once was a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself, not just sometimes, but always. Juster first sent Milo through that magical tollbooth in an electric car in 1961, 60 years ago. And he journeyed into a universe full of strange lands and characters, a world of whimsy, wordplay, and imagination. His first stop was a place called Expectations. "Some people never go beyond expectations," a man tells him. "My job is to hurry them along whether they like it or not." The fellow dispensing that information was the weatherman, not the W-E-A-T-H-E-R, weatherman, as he explains to Milo, for after all, it's more important to know whether there will be weather than what the weather will be. And so it goes in the Phantom Tollbooth until by the end of the journey, Milo is no longer a blasé boy he was at the start. The combination of Norton Juster's lively prose and Jules Pfeiffer's evocative drawings was irresistible, and not just to children. By the way, Juster and Pfeiffer shared a New York duplex at the time they decided to collaborate. Norton Juster was born in 1929 in Brooklyn to Samuel and Minnie Silberman Juster, Romanian Jewish immigrants. His father was an architect, his mother a homemaker. As a child, Norton particularly enjoyed the Wizard of Oz series, but he also dived into the books he found in his parents' collection. They had several shelves of huge Russian and Yiddish novels translated into English, 1,200, 1,500 pages. I would read them and have no idea what I was reading. I just loved the language and the way you read it and how the words sounded. I think that has always affected the way I write. Juster got a B.A. in architecture from Penn, was a Fulbright scholar in city planning in England, spent 3 years in the Navy's engineering corps, then set up shop as an architect in New York, which he continued to do well into the 1990s. In an introduction to a 1996 reissue of The Phantom Tollbooth, Juster said the seed of the book was planted one day when a boy came up to him as he was waiting to be seated in a restaurant. The kid suddenly asked, "What's the biggest number there is?" Juster recalled. It was a startling question, the kind children are so good at. I asked him what he thought the biggest number was, told him to add one to it. He did the same to me. We went back and forth and had a great time talking about infinity, realizing you simply couldn't get there from here. I was intrigued, thrown back into my own childhood memories and the way I used to think about the mysteries of life. I started to compose what I thought would be a little story about a child's confrontation with numbers and words and meanings and other strange concepts imposed on children. Maurice Sendak, another great Jewish children's author whose famed book Where the Wild Things Are came out 2 years after The Phantom Tollbooth, remembered that period fondly as a time when children's authors pushed beyond the blandness of an earlier era, a time he wrote when it was easy to stay clean and fresh and wildly ourselves. But Sendak lamented, time has shown Juster's conjuring of the various allegorical monsters Milo encountered proved all too accurate. Juster's demons of ignorance, the gross exaggeration, shabby, threadbare excuse are inside the walls of the Kingdom of Wisdom, Sendak wrote, while the Gorgons of hate and malice, the overbearing know-it-all, and most especially the triple demons of compromise are already established in high office all over the world. Huh. Well, if you haven't read The Phantom Tollbooth in a while, it's a good time to do so in tribute to Norton Juster of blessed memory. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Ed Hagem is a highly successful financial CEO, founder of companies, entrepreneur. We started to hear the beginning of his story as kidnapped by his father, actually, from his mother, and then brought to California, raised in a variety of complicated ways, and then sent to an orphanage. Tell us the story of that.
Well, he's got to start off with a couple of them. At age five, my father, 1942, when he was drafted, or he joined the Merchant Marines, he decided that the Catholic Welfare Agency was much more attractive than any other welfare agency. So he convinced the Catholics, since I was born in a Catholic hospital, to take me on. And I spent the next five years, in five different Catholic foster homes. In fact, in the fifth one, I'd written my letter to my father saying that I wanted my baptismal certificates because I wanted to become a good Catholic and I wanted to have my first communion.
Oh, I bet he loved that.
Well, he didn't say anything, didn't respond to it because these people, obviously, that I was living with were taking care of me. After the war, my father returned instead to the West Coast. He returned to the East Coast, and I made the trip across country, 20 hours on an airplane, and arrived in New York City. Unfortunately, I was quite late, and my suitcase was filled with my rock collection, which didn't make my father happy, and so the arrival was not well received. We spent the next 45 days in the YMCA on 34th Street, and I learned the city, because my father was out all day long, and so I was be able to go on the subways and so forth. And then finally, but since I had to go to school, we ended up in a hotel room and a half, in Coney Island, and I went to PS 106. My father struggled for a year trying to find a land-based job, but he couldn't do it. And finally, by the summer of 47, he had to go back to sea. And actually got a job going back to sea and was going to put me with one of the neighbors. Turns out in the middle of the summer, the neighbor couldn't take me. And I actually spent, I don't know how long, 3-4 weeks, alone in a hotel room in Coney Island.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is in the book, and it's just surprising. But I got along. I knew the subways, and I kept out of trouble, and he set up a delicatessen for me to do my meals, and luckily nothing happened. And I was supposed to go to live with this neighbor come September when I was going back to school, and she decided she didn't want to do it at all. So Dad was able to contact the Jewish Welfare Agency, and I was put into an orphanage in Far Rockaway, the Israel Orphan Asylum. And I spent 4 years there, and then something awful happened, which I talked about in the book. At age 15, I was too old for the orphanage, but my father disappeared on me. And years and years later, in fact, 2015, I found out that he was in a suit against the union because aboard one of his ships, I guess someone tried to kill him. And
oh my God!
He was saying basically there was huge amounts of
anti-Semitic discrimination.
Anti-Semitism was, one of his callings was anti-Semitism. He was basically felt that he was being treated very badly because he was in an industry where there weren't many Jewish people. Anyway, so at age 15, he disappeared, and I became a ward of the state and was transferred, luckily, to another very good orphanage in Yonkers, New York, called the National Hebrew Orphan Asylum, NHOH, and had a wonderful head director there. His name was Reuben Kaftoff. And the high school was about four blocks away, which was an excellent high school, and I flourished. I was an athlete. I loved math and science. And come to the end of the period, I decided I was going to private college, which everybody said was impossible, given I had no money. In fact, I'd worked every afternoon and saved, as I have written down, I saved over the 2.5-year period of working and being a pin setter, bag boy, soda jerk. I saved $200. You make 50 cents an hour, and get 10 cent tips for carrying bags out. That's what you end up with. Anyway, I applied to every scholarship under the sun. There weren't that many those days, and I missed the New York State scholarship, which I was sure I was going to get. ended up getting an NROTC scholarship, though, which took me to the University of Rochester, and that changed my life.
You know, unbelievable start. Now, you were in contact with your father because he kept sending you letters, except in this weird period when he disappeared.
Very supportive. In fact, my first ghostwriter, we broke apart. She wanted me to hate my father because it was much more dramatic. I loved my father, and I really felt that he was doing what he could do. But he did miss birthdays, and he did miss graduations, and, you know, the relationship did deteriorate over time.
At this point, you thought your mom was dead. Your father was your only family.
I thought my mom was passed away, yeah. And I told that story to everybody, you know. And when I went to college, I decided to bury my background. Psychologists would say today, that's terrible, you know, you'll destroy yourself. Well, it was a very good way for me that I didn't have to explain anything. I could look forward rather than back. Today, kids, and they should let it hang out, but I wasn't willing to do that. The story was my mother died when I was 3. My father was a merchant marine. We lived in a post office box in San Francisco, 4722.
Wow.
And that was it. And nobody asked any questions. I refused to talk about anything else. I was ashamed. And
sure.
You have to place your back self back in 1954. First of all, poor kids didn't go to private colleges.
Right.
And poor kids were different. I mean, I had the wrong clothes. I had the wrong haircut. I got rejected by all the fraternities when I was a freshman, you know, and it was extremely difficult to, I arrived alone, you know, and so, you know, you not hiding my background really made it easier for me. And also I feel it allowed me to go forward, to always look ahead. And, but, you know, after the first year I started to conform, and I was an athlete. I played baseball and basketball for the school, and I did well in my studies, and by the sophomore year, I was kind of on my way. Still being, you know, different, because I didn't, on weekends or holidays, nobody visited me, and I didn't have any place to go, you know.
You just kind of hung around the school.
I worked.
I worked.
I worked most of the time, you know. In the Christmas holiday, I'd work in a post office, and, you know, and wait, and had a great job New Year's Eve waiting. It was because everyone had a good time, and I got a good job and got paid well for being a waiter at New Year's. So I had worked. Then I by my junior year, I had a couple of very good friends, and they took me home to their homes, and it was wonderful except difficult. You know, it was
sure.
Hard seeing other people with, you know, loving families, and here I was, you know, so the odd man out. And it was, you know, I'm right now mixed up with a group called Wiley, that handles foster kids in colleges, and lets them know that they, you know, have, you know, they have social problems. They don't have, most of them have academic problems. I had very little academic problems, although I was an engineer, and it wasn't easy.
No.
chemical engineering. We started with 60 of them, and only 6 of us graduated on time.
So I want to say you've done okay for yourself after that. Tell us just kind of briefly how you got started in the.
Well, you know, I became an chemical engineer, and then I had to spend 3 years in the Navy because of the Navy scholarship, and that was a great experience for me. Being a naval officer was a real learning experience. I reported aboard ship, and the first, you know, the first experience was I had 180 men reporting to a 22-year-old. Men ranged in age from 18 to 55. You become, you know, pretty mature pretty quickly, and I took on a lot of responsibility and had 3 fabulous years and almost stayed in the service. They were one of the big divisions between my father and I, and we really broke pretty hard when I decided to leave the Navy. He didn't want me to leave. He said, a great career, you're a good record, blah, blah, blah. But I decided I'd spent 4 years as an engineer. I was going to go back and, you know, do engineering, even though I got accepted to the University of California, Berkeley Business School, which I was taking night courses while I was in the Navy. And so I went and I became an engineer. I loved it. I was Dustin Hoffman, you know, young man going to plastics, and I went into plastics. But I went to Wharton at night, 3 days a week. Drove from Wilmington to Philadelphia, and took accounting course as well, and business law, and a few other things that decide what I wanted to do. And everybody convinced me that, you know, it wasn't a good idea to go to school at night. And I had a good buddy from Rochester who was at Harvard Business School, and he was convinced I should come. And that's why good friends are so important. He just wouldn't leave me alone. I finally made a late application. Somehow I got in, and Harvard Business School changed my life. I mean, I flourished there. Here I was in competition with the, you know, the Ivy League. I mean, I think a third of the kids graduated from Princeton, you know. And it was, you know, it was a great experience. Again, gaining social graces, meeting lots of interesting people, and it was just a great experience. And I was convinced I was going to be an international businessman, so I I worked in Belgium by summer between my freshman and sophomore year, my first and second year, learned French, spoke French relatively fluently. Then the second year I said, well, Europe's not giving me a whole lot of South America, so I went to Central America with a job trying to create a business school in Nicaragua. I was immersed in Spanish, and I actually learned Spanish and was pretty fluent in Spanish. I realized both jobs told me I didn't want to be an international businessman. It was just too hard. So I took a job. I was going to go to Wall Street, and there's a long, long story. It's in the book. It changed my life. I went to California for a wedding and ended up in the financial business, and you can read the book. It's a great story.
Because it is a great story.
I not only took the job with this company. I had no interest in the company at all. I went there just to get a ticket out to California and go to the wedding, and I ended up marrying the bridesmaid, and a few other things happened during that period. So life is flow, life is luck, but it is a really humorous story because it
sounds like the bridesmaid had her heart set on you for a while from the story.
That goes back to Rochester. I was taken home by a young man, my junior, a classmate below me, to talk about. I was the editor-in-chief of a humor magazine, which I founded. He was the next editor. I went to his house for 3 or 4 days to talk about the magazine, and he had this little sister who was 13 years old buzzing around all the time. When I left, she told her mother and father that she was going to marry me. Of course, they laughed. 7 years later was the wedding. We met, and 2 years later we were married. So
apparently she was right.
I ran after her until she caught me. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And we're married for 55 years now, so it worked out.
Apparently it worked. Ed, there's so much in the book. It's a great story, and you became obviously highly successful manager of huge amounts of assets, developed funds. You then chose to move into philanthropy in a serious way. Tell us a little bit about that. You know, tzedakah is such a central part of Jewish life.
I went from the company in Boston, California. I went to New York, to Wall Street, worked for E.F. Hutton, and I was a partner of Lehman Brothers before they had trouble. Right. Then I found that my dream job was to be the chairman and CEO of a very small investment bank. And over a 20-year period, we grew from 70 people to 800. We sold it to Xerox, bought it back, and then sold it finally to ING, which brought my business career to closure. I had 200 partners, and when we sold the company to ING, about 500 people received compensation for the sale, and it really was a finish. Then, as far as philanthropy is concerned, I started this very early. Given the fact that the scholarship changed my life, I started giving scholarships as soon as I even had a little bit of money. My first scholarship was at the Westchester Community College, where I gave a book scholarship to 10 worthy students. Wasn't very much money. I think it was $25,000. And I started a scholarship at the University of Rochester, and then at Harvard Business School, and was involved in education almost in the beginning. I was the chairman of the board of trustees of the Brunswick School in Greenwich, Connecticut, where my kids went. At Harvard Business School, I became the president of the Alumni Association, ended up on the Dean's Advisory Council. But the biggest philanthropic experience I've had was I spent 20 years as a trustee at the University of Rochester, my alma mater. I ran their endowment for the most part of that. And just before I was going to leave, because the 20 years was enough, a new president came in and said he wanted me to be the chairman of the board. And so I took a gulp and realized I had to, if I wanted to do this, I kind of convinced him I was 72 years old. I said, I'm too old. You know, I can't give you a transformational gift. You know, I don't live in Rochester. And the guy that's the president, chairman's a terrific guy. He's an attorney brother of mine and outstanding. But he convinced me he would change the laws. 72 wasn't too old. We'd figure out a way to do a gift. And then this fraternity brother of mine, who was the president chairman, said, Ed, you have to do it. So I sat around and I figured out how I could give the largest gift in the history of the school, which would allow us to raise a hell of a lot more money. And that began what I call the public part of my life. People started digging to try to find out who I was, because I had lived under the mantra to live happy is to live hidden, and I was hidden most of my life. No social media, you know, really in many respects deflecting interest. I had a couple of magazine articles written, but I objected to any kind of TV and so on, because I felt I wanted to concentrate on my work, and I didn't want to become a public figure. But being the chairman of the board of the University of Rochester, which is a $3 billion, 30,000 person operation, and if you're going to give the largest gift, they want to use your, persona to
raise money, right?
Yeah.
So, it was a great experience for me. I spent 8 years. We raised, the president and I helped raise $1.3 billion, more money than they raised cumulatively in 155 years, put $900 million worth of concrete on the ground, raised, put in more new scholarships, programs, and professorships than any time in the school's history. And it's a great, great experience for me. And they were just so kind to me. They not only named the engineering school after me, which is, I tell everybody, I was so pleased to name the Hazen School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Now there are 400 graduates every year that have to suffer with the pronunciation of my name.
I'm sorry, it should be Chaim. You know that, of course.
It should be Hajim. It's much sexier.
Hajim is very, that's very Levantine, I would say. It's perfect. Kind of.
It's perfect, but it is Hajim, unfortunately. And my blonde, blue-eyed kids suffer with it as well. So, anyway, so they're kind of not only named the school, they named the I spent the basic part of 8 years trying to accumulate, putting all the engineering in one place. And they put a quadrangle together and put my name on it. So there's only two people at University of Rochester that have a quadrangle. The other guy's name is George Eastman.
Oh, I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear of Ed Hajim, but you heard of George.
Well, now we've heard of Ed Hajim. Ed, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
I didn't talk too fast.
No, you're terrific. You've got a voice made for radio, but you're a good-looking guy. Your face is not. So, I want to thank you. The book is called Road Less Traveled, On the Road Less Traveled. Where can people go to find out more about you now that you're, out there?
My website is edhajim.com. So you can go there. All the stuff is there, and you can buy the book right on the website if you'd like. Simon & Schuster is also selling it, plus a few other places. Unfortunately, if you read it and don't like it, there's no refund.
No, sorry. Ed, thanks so much.
All the best.
Thank you very much. Great to meet you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. By the way, Ed Hajim does get reunited with his mother. Got to read the book to find out how. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Seth Farber, founder and director of YITIM, the organization in Israel working to increase participation in Jewish life by making Israel's religious establishment respectful of and responsive to the diverse Jewish needs of its people. We'll discuss the recent Israeli Supreme Court decision accepting non-Orthodox conversions to Judaism in Israel and the way that YITIM has helped Russian Olim and others receive the place they deserve in Israeli society in spite of the worst efforts of the Rabbanut. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Festival of Passover, just 2 weeks away. Don't miss our Apart Together Seder at the Rabbi's Table virtual Seder with me at Congregation Beit Simcha on Facebook Live. A fabulous preview of Passover will be coming up soon. Great way to celebrate this festival of freedom. And this song is an antique but fun Passover medley from the Barry Sisters way back in, the 30s or 40s. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and peace.
Da da yeinu, da da yeinu, da da yeinu, da yeinu, da yeinu, da yeinu, da da yeinu, da da yeinu. Da-da-yeinu, da-yeinu, da-yeinu. Herr, da meins, es ist geschehen, Tag über mein Taten. Ihr seid ziegele gewähn, Herr, da masse Matten. Kimmt der Ketzel, es ist nicht feuer, hab du ziegelein, moin. Chad-gad-jo, chad-gad-jo, chad-gad-jo. Ich gedenk, fünf Egale, es nicken für den Ziegele. Chad-gad-jo, chad-gad-jo, chad-gad-jo. Kelloi, no way. Kelai yawe, kelai nawe, kisr melacha. Kelai nawe, kelai yawe, kelai nawe, kisr melacha. Chevre, 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 bon yerkad yachad. Venashira, venashira, venesmacha, venesmacha. Anu, anu, b'nei tzion, Am Yisrael chai. Kelai nawe, kelai yawe, kelai nawe. Kisr melacha, kelai nawe, kelai yawe, kelai nawe, kisr melacha.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.